Good evening, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. It is July 24th, 2014, and I am Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Ray Goodwin.
Tonight we're bringing you episode 20, moving right along with our reading of this very interesting book. And the date is that we're reading today, is what we're, that we're starting out with, is January 13th, 1942. And according to the timeline, on this day, January 13th, 1942, the Red Army takes Kirov, just west of the Ural Mountains, and Media as their counteroffensive continues. And on another front, the German U-boat offensive comes closer to the U.S. shores, starting the second happy time. And looking up the second happy time, I found it was a time that lasted from January 1942, where we are now, to about August of this year, of that year, and involved several German naval operations. German submarines named it the Happy Time, or the Golden Time, as defense measures were weak and disorganized by the Allies at this time. And Axis submarines sank 609 ships, totaling 3.1 million tons, and the loss, according to Wikipedia, of thousands of lives, mainly those of merchant mariners, against a loss of only 22 U-boats. Historian Michael Gannon called it America's second Pearl Harbor and placed the blame for the nation's failure to respond quickly to the attacks on the inaction of Admiral Ernest J. King, Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Fleet. Well, there we go. That was the only timeline for tonight's program, so thought I'd mention it all.
Good.
All right. Well, so, Mr. Goodwin, are you ready to begin on January 13th?
Absolutely. Okay. 13th January, 1942, evening. Special guest, Field Marshal Lieb and Turbovin.
Now, I have to interrupt again. I didn't think about that, but I didn't look up these people, or did you? Do you want to talk about them?
No.
Okay. General Lieb, Field Marshal Lieb, was an old-school German general, and he did not take well to having his command managed from afar by Hitler, whom he considered an armchair general. Although he cooperated with Hitler pretty well, it seemed to me, and Hitler kept calling him back into World War II, and he did some very, very good commanding, but still there were some problems as Hitler saw them, and in January 1942, just at the time that Lieb is right here in the headquarters, Lieb asked Hitler to relieve him of his command, and Hitler complied. It was officially announced, Lieb was in charge of the advance on Leningrad, and it went very well, and then, I don't know, Hitler was complaining that Lieb was just fiddling around and was seen to be unwilling to continue and go into the city, and they had some disagreement on that. I'm not going to go into all of that, but in any event, it says here that it was announced that Lieb had stepped down due to illness rather than the other reason, rather than because of his defeat, it says here. He had been defeated. Colonel General Georg von Kutler assumed command of the Army Group North. He had been in command of Army Group North, Lieb had. And Hitler never employed Lieb again after this. So you can see that some big things were going on there.
Sure.
And Joseph Turbovin was the Reichskommissar of Norway. I mentioned him once before. He became that on the 24th April 1940 and remained until 1945. Some thought him too heavy-handed. Some were very much, Goebbels complained about him, I read, but he remained in his job until the end of the war. So there we go.
Good, good. But before I start into this particular section is about Czechoslovakia. And I know that probably the majority of folks listening to us are aware what Czechoslovakia was, but just in case, Czechoslovakia was formed out of German territory and Slovak. It was an artificial nation formed at the Versailles Convention. And when I read up on this years ago, it was actually formed, the pretense was to unite these people and all, but it was to have an opening or a track into Germany with military forces if that need arose, either by whatever the enemy might be. But they would have an anti-German Czechoslovakia sitting in a crucial geographical location. And so there was no Czechoslovakia before 1919, and that's the point I was going to make.
Yeah, very important point. And okay. That land there that makes up the bulk of the Czech Republic today, Bohemia and Moravia, have a long history of Germans being there and
yes.
German connection and so on. So it's... you know, the Czechs were never, like you said, they were never an organized nation until, but they were very, they they self-identified themselves very strongly.
Mm-hmm.
So they had that. But,
that's right. Okay. The Fuhrer says, I know the Czechs. At present, they're very undecided. Some of them would like an understanding with Germany. The others are supporters of Beneš. A weak policy in Czechoslovakia would be the equivalent on our part to a deliberate hunt for disaster. If the Austrian state had acted energetically towards them, it would have avoided dismemberment. My first intervention dates 2.5 years back. We had to shoot 9 agitators and send 2,500 people into concentration camps. Order was restored instantly. The Czechs' behavior toward the old Austria was a complete expression of the meaning of the phrase passive resistance. The most impertinent are always those who are treated with the greatest respect. In their eyes, consideration is a sign of weakness or stupidity. I'd rather be regarded as a brute than as an idiot. I'm convinced that the Czechs will end by releasing Haka.
Regarding
Haka as one of the greatest political figures in their history. Now, that's Emil, and his last name spelled H-A-C-H-A. The Czechs around here tell me that pronunciation is Haha. In 1939, I gave them an ultimatum by the terms of which they had until 6 o'clock to accept my proposals. Otherwise, German aircraft would be over Prague. I would have irremediably lost face if I'd had to put this threat into execution, for at the hour mentioned, fog was so thick over our airfields that none of our aircraft could have made its sortie. At 3 o'clock, the meeting with Haha was over. He informed his government, and 3/4 hour later, we were notified that the order had been carried out. German troops would enter Czechoslovakia without striking a blow. The Czechs had their army well under control. The order sent by Haha had been framed by my advisors. Haha's visit caused me concern, for he was a very fragile old gentleman. Imagine the uproar in the foreign press if anything had happened to him. In the morning, he was animated by a spirit of resistance that contrasted with his usual behavior. He especially opposed the idea that his Minister of Foreign Affairs should countersign our agreement. I said to myself, look out, here's a lawyer I have facing me. Perhaps there was an arrangement in Czechoslovakia giving the force of law only to an agreement of this sort if it was countersigned by the minister in question. On the following day in Prague, Haha asked me what we had done to make such a different man of him. He was himself astonished to have suddenly shown such obstinacy. It was probably the result of the injection Morel had given him to build him up again. His renewed energy turned against us. At present, I receive from Haha the warmest messages of sympathy. I don't publish them so as not to create the impression that we need the support of an underdog.
That's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there you have Hitler giving his version to his friends sitting around him there,
mm-hmm.
Of how things took place. So you have to, I don't believe that he would be putting on some act, or he would be saying things that weren't the way they were in a environment like this.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, you know, that's the way he saw it. Now, he didn't have any problem with, well, they like to use the word bullying, but, you know, kind of pressing on Chacha and mm-hmm. insisting that he go along with Hitler's plans. He didn't mm-hmm. have any problem. As he said, we didn't need him to vouch for us or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I think he did pass out. He got kind of ill, Chacha. And so they called in Dr. Morell, and Dr. Morell gave him an injection. And according to Hitler himself here, he's saying that this injection just made a new man of Chacha, right?
Mm-hmm.
Immediately, mm-hmm. and he was just, you know, full of spirit of resistance in him that he didn't have mm-hmm. before. And that tells you something about Morell's injection. So that's what Hitler got from Morell, which kept mm-hmm. him on top of his game, you know.
Right.
And Hitler got, he wanted to be on top of his game, and he knew he was when he, you know, when he felt that good. And so he did allow himself to continue using these things from Morell, but I don't know that they're necessarily, some, you read different things about them, but that they were necessarily so strong that they made him into a drug addict or something,
mm-hmm.
or, and, you know, destroyed his health and his mind later on. I don't know. I don't believe that. It could, you know, a lot of things are possible, but it's not really known. But I don't think Morell was that irresponsible. However, he did get this help, Hitler, and that's part of why he was so effective during these years.
Right.
And during the war, you know, when he had to really function at the top of his game, he needed that.
Oh, yeah.
I would say so. I don't know that he made a bad decision.
Right. Right. And, you know, this particular incident, when he says he gave Chacha the ultimatum by the terms of which they had until 6 o'clock or our German aircraft would be over Prague, this was that supposed that the Allies made real hay out of the sellout of poor Czechoslovakia by Chamberlain when Chamberlain came back saying, I have peace in our time.
Mm-hmm.
We've ironed this thing out.
Mm-hmm.
So the German forces marched into Czechoslovakia totally unopposed. And, of course, this was really blasted to the world through the press that this is just another example of Hitler trying to gobble up the world. I think about things like that when I read this about Czechoslovakia and how it was... The publicity against Germany was, inaccurate in the press, the reports on what really went on, but it was certainly just portrayed for the benefit of the Jews, for lack of a...
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the Czechs have a different personality from the Poles, and
mm-hmm.
I think the Czechs were smart to go along with Hitler because they really didn't have any choice, and this Chacha realized that it was just going to be a problem, and maybe they weren't prepared to fight back and resist. They hadn't been thinking along those lines the way that the Poland had been for years, you know.
Yeah.
But Poland continued to resist, and they suffered for it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they want to make themselves out to be victims. If they hadn't behaved the way they had and continued to be, you know, enemy of Germany
yes.
throughout the whole thing, well, they wouldn't have had such a hard time. The Czechs certainly didn't have a hard time. They might have had to swallow some pride for a while, but they've gotten it all back now, and mm-hmm. they even got some revenge and so on. So
right, but the Czechs at that time, Carolyn, did have a huge army.
Yes, they did.
You know, and it was like right. the second largest one in that whole area. So as far as if their leaders had said, fight.
They would have, yes.
Yes, yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah, but this guy didn't, so...
Right, right. And like you said, very smart for his nation that he didn't.
Well, I think so, because the Czechs really did all right. They came out probably better than almost, I don't know, maybe not better than anybody else, but they sure came out good throughout that whole war. The little bit that went on there that they complained about was really nothing compared to what happened elsewhere.
Right. Yeah. Okay, the night of the 13th and 14th of January, 1942. After a hearing of Bruckner's Seventh Symphony.
Yeah, now this whole thing is kind of about art and so on, so just to let people know.
Yes. This work is based on popular airs of Upper Austria. They're not textually reproduced, but repeatedly I recognize in passing Tyrolean dances of my youth. It's wonderful what he managed to get out of that folklore. As it happened, it's a priest to whom we must give the credit for having protected this great master. The Bishop of Linz used to sit in his cathedral for hours at a time listening to Bruckner play the organ. He was the greatest organist of his day.
Now, Bruckner, just to tell people, Anton Bruckner was an Austrian. He composed music, and he was an organist. And he ended up being Hitler's favorite composer. And he thinks Hitler thought the Seventh Symphony, which he mentioned here, was just one of the finest things he'd ever heard. Now, of course, his big favorite was Wagner, but Wagner was a composer, but he composed operas a little bit different from Bruckner. So they were both his favorites.
Oh, yeah. One can imagine this obscure peasant's arrival in Vienna amidst an effete society. One of Bruckner's opinions of Brahms was published in a newspaper recently and further increased the sympathy I felt for him. Brahms' music is very beautiful, but I prefer my own. And that's what Bruckner had written. There you have the self-awareness, full both of humility and of pride, such as a peasant can feel in all simplicity when he is inspired by a true conviction. The critic Hanslick depicted Bruckner's life in Vienna as a real hell for him. When the moment came when it was no longer possible to ignore his work, he was covered with decorations and overwhelmed with honors. What did all that mean to him? Wouldn't it have been better not to have misunderstood him so long? Jewry had raised Brahms to the pinnacle. He was lionized in the salons and was a pianist of theatrical gestures. He exploited effects of the hands, effects of the beard and hair. Compared to him, Bruckner was a man put out of countenance, an abashed man. Wagner also had the feeling for gesture, but with him it was innate. Wagner was a man of the Renaissance, like Goring in a certain aspect, and it would be silly to blame him. There is nothing crueler than to live in a milieu that has no understanding for a work already achieved or in the process of gestation. When I think of a man like Schiller or Mozart, who was flung nobody knows where into a communal grave, what ignominy. If I hadn't been there to prevent it, I believe the same thing would have happened to Troost. That man revolutionized the art of building. Perhaps it would have taken a few years, and he'd have died without anyone having the slightest idea of his genius. When I got to know him, he was depressed, embittered, disgusted with life. It often happens that architects are hypersensitive people. Think merely of Hansen, who was the most richly gifted of the architects of Vienna. And Hasenauer? The critics had attacked him so savagely that he committed suicide before his great work was finished. And yet the Vienna Opera House, so marvelously beautiful, puts the Paris Opera into the shade. To know that one is capable of doing things that nobody else can do, and to have no possibility of giving proof of it. It seems that people should make sacrifices for their great men as a matter of course. A nation's only true fortune is its great men.
Yeah, this is so good. But before we go on with that, maybe I'll just mention to people that Troost, he's speaking about with his last name only, is Paul Troost, and he was the first, he was an architect, of course, but he was the first official NSDAP architect. for the party. He was the party's architect until he died. And when he died, that's when Speer was around. Hitler kind of picked Speer to take that place. But he did a lot of very, very nice work for the party.
It seems that people should make sacrifices for their great men as a matter of course. A nation's only true fortune is its great men. A great man is worth a lot more than 1,000 million in the state's coffers. A man who's privileged to be the head of a country couldn't make a better use of his power than to put it at the service of talent. If only the party will regard it as its main duty to discover and encourage the talents. It's the great men who express a nation's soul. I had extraordinary luck, but the German people had even more. The 7 infantry divisions and 3 cavalry divisions of 1933 would not have stopped the tidal wave from the east.
Wow, that's really good, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I like that section because, Carolyn, as I was saying to you earlier, this Hitler saw his own problems, the way he was hunted by the state, pursued by the powers that be, when he tried to get his political movement off the ground, and that they refused to recognize his leadership, how people followed him and things like this. And he was depressed, obviously, and embittered and sometimes disgusted with life himself. His own talents were just as these fellows that he's mentioning here, the artist, the architect, the music, they were ignored. And yet they were great men. And think what they could have done had their talents been recognized earlier or at all. And I think he felt a kinship with fellows like that who had been the state had lost out by not using their talent.
Well, right, and I like too that he makes it very clear what that he thinks that a great nation is great because of its great men,
mm-hmm.
that is individuals, and that's a part of the the National Socialist philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, the fascist philosophy too, I think,
mm-hmm.
where it's individuals that make things happen,
yes.
It's not everybody, but everybody benefits from it. And if they can find and recognize and follow the great men, then they will be doing well.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then he even says, you know, I think he's saying that he's one of them. And
well, yes.
That the German people were lucky that he came along, because what they were doing, what they had to defend themselves in 1933 with the intentions of the Soviet Union being what they were, would certainly not have been sufficient.
Well, yeah, and your remarks about the National Socialist Party, they were exactly right on. And I saw that in the sentence near the end of that section where he says, if only the party will regard it as its main duty to discover and encourage the talents.
Yes.
Yeah,
that's another thing he's always saying, and that's why they were a meritocracy. And
mm-hmm.
he said, we have to find the most talented and encourage them and bring them along, and, we have to seek them out, give them the opportunity.
Right.
Yeah, he was big on that, and of course, as you pointed out, he was a perfect example of that, because he didn't come from any privileged background, and nobody
right.
would have picked him out in the normal society.
And he existed in under a government that was not at all focused on meritocracy. He would have gone nowhere had he not forced his way.
Right. And then all those people who were aristocrats wished he had gone nowhere.
Yeah, well, that's true. 15th of January, 1942, evening. On his return to England, Churchill will have no difficulty in getting round the House of Commons, but the people whose fortunes are in India won't let the wool be pulled over their eyes. Already an English newspaper is so bold as to write, "Send everything to India," without bothering about Russia or North Africa. Nowadays, the possessing class has only one idea. How are we to save the empire? It's not impossible that a miracle may take place and England may withdraw from the war. A year ago, she could have made peace and retained all her prestige. In this war, in the event of victory, only America will gain an advantage. In the event of defeat, it's England who will be the only loser.
Now, here he says, in the event of victory, I think he means an Allied victory.
Yes, yes, that's what he means.
Only America will gain an advantage, and how right he was.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Of course,
right.
Soviet Union gained an advantage,
oh, yeah.
too.
Yeah.
But he's kind of thinking about the West.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I read today that India at present numbers 388 million inhabitants, which means an increase of 55 million during the last 10 years. It's alarming. We are witnessing the same phenomenon in Russia. The women there have a child every year. The chief reason for this increase is the reduction in mortality due to the progress made by the health services. What are our doctors thinking of? Isn't it enough to vaccinate the whites? So much the worse for the whites who won't let themselves be vaccinated. Let them croak. All the same, because these people's fixed ideas, we can't sterilize all the natives.
Well, what's he getting at there?
Now,
I think he's being kind of sarcastic something. I was reading this as, what are our doctors thinking of? Isn't it enough to vaccinate the whites? I don't know what he's. I didn't actually spend the time to figure that out.
The only thing that I could relate to that was his mentioning the high birth rates of India and, of course, Russia, and of course, one of the National Socialist ambitions from the start was to increase the population of Germany,
right,
and get the birth rate up higher.
Yeah,
because they saw that as the future.
Well, sure, and they needed this younger generation coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think he's seeing Russia as having too many, as mm-hmm. growing too much,
yes.
like India. But further on, they say that the Germans are doing the same thing. But here, he seems to be saying that that they're reducing the mortality mm-hmm. by the improved health services, and he thinks they're overdoing it. That's what he seems to be saying, but for Russia and India, maybe he doesn't approve of. I mean, that's just a personal thing. He's
yeah,
not thinking that it should actually.
Well, to me, when he's saying the chief reason for that increase of population in India and Russia is because of the progress made by the way I took it was their health services. And so then he turns around and says, what are our doctors thinking of? Isn't it enough to vaccinate the whites? And certainly the vaccinations against diseases and things like this was what he was talking about. And so...
Yeah, and he approved of that at
yes,
the time.
Yes,
that was approved of at the time. And some of those early ones were necessary.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And he says, and so much for those white people who won't let themselves be vaccinated, let them croak, you know, because what he's trying to do is say, hey, people, I'm trying to make sure that our people survive and grow, and if you turn your backs on our health services, hey, you know, you're risking it all at the cost of to the detriment of the nation. So,
yeah.
And then
he's saying we can't sterilize all the natives, so he's talking about those other countries.
Yes, yes.
He's talking maybe about Russia, which is where they're going into.
Yeah.
And maybe he doesn't want, he says they've got these ideas, which is that they're going to have a child every year. You're not going to change that too easily, and you can't sterilize them, so I don't know. I wish I understood a little bit more what he was getting at.
Right, it should have been a little bit clearer, yeah.
Yeah, or the guy should have written more about
it. Yeah, right. And then the note is stuck in here that Bormann put in that of the 50 families in Ober-Salzburg, 24 had children in 1941.
Pretty interesting.
Yeah, and that's pretty high. I mean, that's 40%.
Yeah, it is.
That's a pretty doggone high birth rate.
Well, that's more than 40%. 25 would be 50%. So it's about 50%.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, I
yeah.
see that now. Huh?
Yeah.
That brings us close to the Russian birth rate. I've always said that the only problem for us is the housing problem. The children will come of themselves. A great convenience for the parents is blocks of buildings with communal gardens inside where the children can play freely and still be under supervision. It's no longer possible to leave them on the road.
When they're all, I thought that was funny.
Yeah, I did too. When they're all together, it's easier to make social beings of them. At Regensburg, I saw a settlement teeming with children. In Germany, likewise, the birth rate is rising.
Well, Regensburg is in Germany, so I don't know why he put it that way. It sounds funny. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I'm just going to take a moment to tell a real quick little story here from Willy Wenger, who, you know, was just a boy in 1939 and in 1938, too. And in 38, of course, there was the Anschluss between Austria and Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And they all then became part of the German Reich, and they were very happy. And Hitler had announced that to be a real National Socialist family, you had to have four children, that a real National Socialist family had four children. Well, at that time, his family was, they were three of them, him and his two siblings, and his his mother had another child after that, and then he said, he made the comment that his friend had pointed that out to him, that his mother was pregnant because he hadn't even noticed it, but he was still in like grade school, and that there were a lot of new children born in 1939. So that's how eager and willing the Austrians were to follow along. You know, it makes me feel, you know, kind of touches my heart that they were going to be real National Socialist families, and there were lots of children born in that year, that following year. And it was continuing on into 1941, obviously, you know.
Right.
Everybody was doing their part for the most part.
And, you know, I realize I didn't put the right emphasis on those last two sentences, Carolyn, where he says, at Regensburg, I saw a settlement teeming with children. In Germany, likewise, the birth rate is rising. So what, Regensburg, of course, is a city in Germany, but what it's like me saying, you know, I noticed a huge increase in the population of Dallas, Texas, a high birth rate, and the United States as a whole, the birth rate is rising.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
So that's
what he means.
Yeah, that's what he means by that.
Yeah, good for you.
Okay, the night of the 15th and 16th of January, 1942. In the old Austria, nothing could be done without patronage. That's partly explained by the fact that 9 million Germans were, in fact, rulers in virtue of an unwritten law of 50 million non-Germans.
Okay, now just to make sure people understand, we're talking about the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Habsburg Empire, and that was a large number of Germans, mostly in the Austrian section, and then a lot of Slavic people mixed, you know, in the more eastern part, in the Hungarian area. And there were a lot of Czechs there, and it's been said that in the Habsburg Empire, the bureaucrats were the Germans. That the Germans pretty much ran everything, that's why it all functioned so well.
Yeah.
And nobody really. I don't know that there was really anybody really minded it too much, but maybe some of them were resentful. But I don't think also that the Germans lorded it over for that reason, but they were just busy, you know, running the bureaucracy of that big empire and doing a pretty good job.
Oh, yeah, and that his use of that one phrase in there really struck a good chord with me. Of course, it's totally politically incorrect today, but when he said 9 million Germans were, in fact, rulers, and then the expression, in virtue of an unwritten law of 50 million non-Germans, well, that unwritten law is the cream rises to the crop. The talent steps forward and takes control.
Yeah, right.
This German ruling class took strict care that places should always be found for Germans. For them, this was the only method of maintaining themselves in this privileged situation. The Balts of German origin behaved in the same way towards the Slav population.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, now he's himself saying that the Germans had a privileged situation in that,
yeah.
and that they made sure that that Germans were always going to be represented.
Yeah,
and then it made me think of how the Jews operate, and that's exactly how they operate. They make sure that they find places for other Jews, and so the Jews, the Jewish rulership keeps going. So the Germans were able to do that too. It's not that they or maybe other white groups are not able to do that, but something happened to stop them from being able to look out for themselves. I would say, you know, it's not that we don't have it in us to look
right.
out for ourselves.
That's right. One got absolutely nothing in Austria without letters of introduction. When I arrived in Vienna, I had one to Roller, but I didn't use it. If I'd presented myself to him with this introduction, he'd have engaged me at once. No doubt it's better that things went otherwise. It's not a bad thing for me that I had to have a rough time of it. In the old days...
You know, he wrote about all that. I guess it was in Mein Kampf.
Yes, yeah.
I read about it.
That's
yeah.
where I remembered it.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. In the old days, there was 10 times as much corruption as today. The difference is that one didn't talk about it. When we condemn a swindler, it's not necessary to take that as an occasion for loud shouts. We haven't any endemic disease, only particular cases. I'm convinced of the necessity of the Führers not having protégés and not admitting any system of favoritism around him. I myself have never had recourse to it. I owe it to my job to be absolutely deaf in that respect. Otherwise, where would we go? I'll take a case, for example, in which I might spontaneously have the intention of doing something for someone. It would be sufficient for one of the people near me to propose something similar, and I'd be obliged to give up my idea, for people might suppose I wasn't acting freely, and I don't want to create the impression that it's possible to have influence with me.
I think that was very...
smart.
Yeah.
Very smart.
Yeah.
In the Wehrmacht, it takes 5 days for an order from me to be translated into action. In the party, everything is done quickly and simply. It's in the party that we find our power of action. If the Italians had succeeded in former times in getting their hands on the Erzberg, their requirements of iron ore would have been covered for 200 years to come. Those are the strategic reserves that drove them in that direction. I think the world's stocks of iron ore will run out, but we already possess light metals that are harder than steel. Coal will run out, too. We'll replace it by other natural forces, air and water.
Well, the Erzberg mine was a mine. It was a large open-pit mine located in Eisenerz, Styria, that's in the central western part of Austria, between Graz and Vienna. So I guess he was pretty familiar with it.
Two dangerous trades, the miners and the sailors. It's claimed that women have no creative genius, but there's one extraordinary woman, and it irritates me that men don't do her justice. Angelica Kauffman was a very great painter. The most illustrious of her own contemporaries admired her.
Now, I just have to stop here, and I just love Hitler for saying this. I was just so thrilled when I read that.
Well, it means that his recognition of talent was not limited, you know, to strictly men.
Well, that's right, and we know that he generally talks about men, and he believed men should rule, but here he is. He always gave the fair assessment to all the bright and talented women that
right.
were functioning in the Reich. But here, you know, he points out that it's claimed that women have no creative genius, but he's saying that can't be true because there's this one. And I looked her up and read about her, and she is not. She was a wonderful painter. I looked at a lot of her paintings, and I must say, you have to look at a whole, you know, number of them to really get an idea. Exceptional, and had her own kind of style and perspective, but I've never heard of her. And she's not well known, I don't think, unless you're really into, you know, professional art history circles.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were some cases that I read about that certain men wrote parodies about her and made fun of her. And there was even a painting painted by somebody where they have her dressed up real goofy in this big, huge bonnet thing. Mm-hmm. Sitting at her easel, and they called her some kind of a name I forget now. But, you know, all that, that's the way so many men, sorry, I have to get this in here, will treat a woman that mm-hmm. they just don't want to think that women can be up, you know, can be up there with the men.
Right.
So I knew you'd appreciate that.
Well, sure, and I do, seriously.
Yeah.
For Lynn's Museum, I can think of only one motto. To the German people, that which belongs to it.
Yep.
The Munich Pinakothek is one of the
Pinakothek.
Pinakothek
mm-hmm.
is one of the most magnificent achievements in the world. It's the work of one man. What Munich owes to Ludwig I is beyond computing, and what the whole German people owes to him. The Palace of Uffizi at Florence does honor not to Florence alone, but to all Italy. I must do something for Königsberg. With the money Funk has given me, I shall build a museum in which we shall assemble all we found in Russia. I'll also build a magnificent opera house and a library. I propose to unify the museums of Nuremberg. That will result in a wonderful collection, and I'll have a new Germanic museum built in that city. On the present sites, I'm always afraid a fire may break out. During the past century, the German people has had pleasure from the museums of Berlin, Munich, Dresden, Vienna, and Kassel. There's nothing finer than to offer the nation monuments dedicated to culture. I also want to see to the new Trondheim. In time, wars are forgotten. Only the works of human genius are left. And you know, one thing that kind of caught my eye, Carolyn, was when he says... about Russia, we shall assemble all we found in Russia, and about building new museums resulting in the wonderful collection. And you think, you take an anti-Hitler today, anti-National Socialist, would look at that and say, yeah, see, they're art thieves, just like that movie that's out now portrays them. You know, mm-hmm. they were interested in stealing all the art and wealth and things. And then he says, on the present sites, meaning where they were presently stored, I'm always afraid a fire may break out. So the museums that he was talking about building would have been much more structurally safe for the art that resides inside them than
right.
where they were.
Very good point. Very good point. And when he says he wants to build something for Königsberg, which mm-hmm. is in Russia
mm-hmm.
Today, it was German, it's Prussia. It was Prussia, but it's become Russia. And it's, what is it called today? I always forget. Is that the one that is Leningrad or something? Anyway, it's way north. And he says, we shall assemble all we found in Russia. Now, they may have found lots of stuff in lots of places, you know, and
right.
they're going to assemble it there and keep it for posterity. Mm-hmm. They're not stealing it and putting it in their homes or...
Right.
You know, I mean, it's just it's a way you have to look at civilization.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, you know, when you're taking over a country, you're doing things that you might not think should be done, but that's the way it happens when you're taking over.
Right. Right. Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, I think that Leningrad was first known as St. Petersburg.
Yeah, St. Petersburg. What did Königsberg become?
I can't. You know, you mentioned that,
looking,
and I should know it, too.
I'm in here now.
But, okay. We'll go into the night of the 16th, 17th, January 1942. And this is a particularly long section, so we may break in occasionally with some comments here. Okay.
Oh, this is the long one, yeah.
Yeah.
It's really long. And mm-hmm. this is wonderful reminiscences that he's going to go into. And the fact that it's so long, I'm looking at Königsberg still here.
Okay.
What is it? Kaliningrad. Is it Kaliningrad now? I don't know about
those. Don't know.
I guess so. Anyway, it was Königsberg in Prussia. It was terrible that it was lost.
Yes.
From the Germans, I think, and the Prussia was destroyed. Anyway, I'll look at that more later. This is, you know, I think the reason that this is so long, and this is a nighttime, it was went over past midnight, you know, one of those late
sure.
night talks of his. But it must have been that everything was written down just about, rather than just
yes.
choosing. And I just have this sense that Bormann was there, and he would have signaled to, once Hitler got talking about this, he would have signaled to Heim, keep writing, you know,
sure.
take it all down, because, boy, he must have been one busy guy taking the notes on this.
And I'm very glad you brought that up, because this system jumps right, this section right here jumps right back into the early history of the National Socialists and their formation, their early trials. I mean, you know, it was lucky they survived. So he's jumping back here the early 1920s, you know, to 1922, 23, 25. That's why.
And somebody must have... Something must have been said that got him
yes.
started on that.
Yeah.
And he really went into it.
Oh, yeah. And a lot of this, what he talks about is fascinating because, you know, as our listeners are going to hear, he goes into the part where he had to go into hiding himself and to adopt a different name on occasion to keep the authorities from arresting him. So it's a pretty interesting piece.
Right.
Okay, night of the 16th, 17th, January, 1942. Now, is that the Hochlinzer?
Hochlinzer.
Hochlinzer was built in 1672. It's a region where there are traces of very ancient habitation. There's a reason for that, for through here past the old salt route that led from Hallein to Augsburg, passing through Salzburg and Berchtesgaden. Hallthurm was a landmark on this route. I don't suppose our ancestors considered this region very inviting. Every year about Christmas, the children rigged themselves out in terrifying masks, a survival of a period when people thought that in this way they could chase away evil spirits. Bad spirits gather in wild and desolate regions. Imagine this narrow road where the traders obliged to pass that way lived in constant fear of attack, either by wild beasts or by brigands. They needed a whole day to cover a distance that today takes us 20 minutes. In the spot where I have my house, there was nothing before 1917, nothing but fields. I think it was in 1917 that the Winter family of Buxtehude built the little house on whose site that I built mine. The visit to Obersalzberg that made the keenest impression on me was the visit I made at the time when my house was being built. It was my first for several months, and I was full of the excitement of discovery. The main work had only just been finished. The dimensions of the house made me somewhat afraid it would clash with the landscape. I was very glad to notice that, on the contrary, it fitted in very well. I had already restricted myself for that reason, for, to my taste, it should have been still bigger. The house that belonged to Cornelius Sonnenkopfel was celebrated. The Becksteins wanted me to acquire it, but I set too much store by the view in the direction of Salzburg, perhaps out of nostalgia for my little fatherland. Moreover, it's too warm in summer at Sonnenkopfel. The Berghof has a truly ideal situation. How I'd like to be up there. It will be a glorious moment when we can climb up there again. But how far away it is, terribly far. To put it briefly, it was Dietrich Eckert who introduced me to Obersalzberg. There was a warrant out for his arrest, and we were seeking to hide him. First of all, he'd taken refuge at Munich with the law box. But he couldn't resist the temptation to telephone right and left. Already, by the second day, he was clamoring that his girlfriend Anna should go and visit him. "I'm incapable of hiding," he used to say. We decided to fetch him back to his home. As a precautionary measure, patrols of ours used to watch the house. Here and there, one could see the silhouette of a policeman sticking up, but they were too cowardly to embroil themselves with us. Christian Weber came to see me and tell me about the Bruckners of Obersalzberg, whom I didn't... whom I didn't yet know. Weber had just had been their paying guest, and he thought it would be just the place for hiding Dietrich Eckert. The Bruckners ran the Pension Moritz. Now, that word pension there, I think in this case, refers to like a boarding house of some kind or a place where a lot of people would stay.
That's right.
That's right.
So this is a kind of a touristy area in a way, although there wouldn't have been tourists at that time like there are today, because mostly only people with money could travel around and so on. But it was that kind of area where you'd meet a lot of different people. But it still had very much the flavor and the way of life of southern Germany and like they were in Austria.
Yeah, and if they
and
built
rural,
something,
very rural.
Yeah, and if they did build something like the magnificent places to stay, as they did there at Moritz, what he talks about there, it's obviously because it's on a pretty heavily traveled route. And so there were several of these, for lack of a better word, I call them boarding houses, that Hitler is going to mention during this time that was very tough for the early National Socialist Party.
Yeah, a lot of these places were nice enough. I mean, they were reputable, but they weren't fancy. They weren't luxurious.
Right.
And just, you know, you just meet all kinds of people, ordinary people there, kind of ordinary.
Mm-hmm. He says, "One day Rome telephoned to me asking me to go and see him immediately at the office of our military administration. There was a wanted persons service there that functioned in parallel with that of the civil police. Rome told me that an attempt would be made to arrest Eckert during the night, and he advised me to take him elsewhere. I had myself observed that the house was beginning to be hemmed in by policemen. A little later in the day, I learned from Rome that all the roads around Munich had been barred. Take him to the English garden, he told me. There you'll find a Reichswehr vehicle that I'm putting at his disposal. I commented to Rome that Eckert would certainly not consent to depart by himself. So much the better, said Rome. It will be excellent if the vehicle is full. I went to see Drexler and ask him if he would like to go off for a few weeks with Dietrich Eckert. He was enthusiastic at the proposal. Eckert began by jibbing at the idea, but in the evening he let himself be led off. All this happened during the winter 1922-23. So they went up to Obersalzberg, where there was still a lot of snow. I've had no details of that journey."
You know what comes to my mind? It didn't when I first read it, but now it does. That here he is in 1942 talking about what was going on in 1922 and mentioning Ernst Röhm, who later on was killed in the, executed, you might say, in the
Night of the Long
Knives. Yeah, what's called that.
Yeah.
In the cleansing. Yeah. And he doesn't seem to have any feeling of, I don't want to mention his name or something, or, oh, gosh, he doesn't seem to feel bad, or, I don't mean to make him out to be an amoral person, because I don't think so at all, but he doesn't feel guilt about it. I mean, it's just a fact, it's just what happened.
Right.
To be done.
That's a good point.
But it's kind of interesting, because he's just putting him in the story.
Yeah, one thing we might hit on a little bit here is a Dietrich Eckert. You know, I'm sure that people listening to this, for the most part, know that he was what would be a good term for him, mentor, guru, whatever, for the National Socialist idea. And he was very valuable.
Oh, yeah. And at the end of this, Hitler talks about what a loss it was when he died, and he died fairly young, you know, but he had a bad heart. And he said, he just can't praise him enough. Said he was just so intelligent and so witty and had such great ideas. And then he called him the polar star of our polar star, meaning, I think, the National Socialist movement.
Yes. And that's, you know, that's why this talk here about hiding Dietrich Eckart makes sense, because the authorities were trying to kill what they considered the National Socialist a snake by cutting off its head. If they could take Dietrich Eckart out of the picture, it would deal Hitler's party a severe blow. And so that's what he's talking about here. Let's hide Dietrich Eckart. Get him out of the way, because the police are closing in and wanting to arrest him.
Yeah, they had some kind of reason that they were going to, something that he had done that they thought they could arrest him on.
Right. Next day, the police came to my house. They knew nothing, of course. That reminds me that we used to treat these police fellows very rudely. When we were telephoning and suspected that the line was tapped, we used to exclaim at once, "Good God, another of these chimpanzees taking an interest in us." Christian Weber gave us news regularly. All that I knew was that they were in a boarding house somewhere near Berchtesgaden. One day in April, I went to Berchtesgaden, accompanied by my young sister. I told her that I had to have an interview on the mountain, and I asked her to wait for me. I set off on foot with Weber. The path rose sharply and went on and on, a narrow path through the snow. I asked Weber whether he took me for a chamois and threatened to turn back and return by day. Then we found a house before us, the Pension Moritz. Weber said to me, "No knocks at the door. We can go in." As a precaution, we had not announced ourselves. Eckart, brought from his bed, came to meet us in his nightshirt, displaying heels bristling with hair like barbed wire. He was very much moved. I asked Eckart at what hour I should get up the next day in order to admire the landscape. He told me that it was marvelous at 7:30. He was right. What a lovely view over the valley, a countryside of indescribable beauty. Eckart was already downstairs. He introduced me to the Buchners. "This is my young friend, Herr Wolf." Nobody could think of forming any connection between this person and that crazy monster Adolf Hitler. Eckart was known at the boarding house under the name Dr. Hoffman. At midday, he took me to the Turken Inn, promising me a genuine goulash. He was addressed there as Herr Doktor, but I saw at once that everybody knew his real identity. When I mentioned this to him, he answered that there were no traitors in Obersalzberg. After a meeting at Freilassing, he had spoken under the name of Hoffman, but during the speech, he had become carried away by passion and had so far forgotten himself as to say, "What's that nonsense you're telling me? Why, I'm better informed than you are. I'm Dietrich Eckart." He blew his cover.
He's incorrigible. I guess he was, but somehow he was still brilliant.
Oh, yeah. I didn't stay there long and went back to Munich. But every time I had a few free days, I used to return up there. We often went on excursions. Once we were caught in the Pertscheller hut by a terrible storm, so fierce we thought the hut was about to fly away. Dietrich Eckart cursed. What folly to have shut myself up in such a wretched shanty. Another time, Buchner took Eckart on his motorcycle. I can still see them climbing at full speed the stiff, winding path to Obersalzberg. What a team! A day came when it was impossible to keep Eckart at the boarding house any longer. People were saying everywhere that a horde of policemen was coming to pick him up. One afternoon, we moved him into Gall's little house. As he always did when he moved, he took with him his bed and his coffee grinder. I had become immediately attached to Obersalzberg. I'd fallen in love with the landscape. The only people who knew who I was were the Buchners, and they kept the secret. All the others thought of me as Herr Wolf, so it was very amusing to hear what people said at table about Hitler.
I wish he would tell us what this is.
I do too, because he does make a little reference to this a little bit later, but yeah, you're right. I wish he would have described some of the things he heard. I decided to go to Passau for a meeting. Our boarding house had a customer accompanied by a very pretty wife. We were chatting together, and suddenly he said to me, "I've come from Holstein as far as Berchtesgaden. I refuse to miss the opportunity for seeing this man Hitler. So I'm going to Passau." It seemed to me that this was a bad lookout for me and that I would lose my incognito. I told him I was going there too and offered to take him in my car. When we reached Passau, a car was waiting for me. I went ahead and warned my friends that I was Herr Wolf, asking them to avoid any gaffes with the braggart whom I was leaving in their care. I invited the braggart to come into the meeting with my friends, telling him I'd join him in the hall. The fact was that I had to take off the overalls hiding my uniform. I immediately recognized my man by his stupidly scarred face, lost in the confused uproar of the hall. When he saw me mount the platform and begin to speak, he fixed his eyes upon me as if I were a ghost. The meeting ended in a terrible brawl, in the course of which Schreck was arrested. I took my companion back to Obersalzberg. He was dumbfounded. I begged him to keep my secret, telling him that if I were recognized, I should be obliged to change my place of refuge, and that this would be a great vexation. He gave me his word. On the way back, it was Göring who was at the wheel. He drove like a madman. On a bend, before we arrived at Tittmoning, we suddenly found ourselves on a dung heap. Maurice took over the wheel again and drove us back to Berchtesgaden without further obstacle. Next day, I could see from the way the braggart's wife had, of staring at me, that he had spoken to her. But towards the others, he had been entirely discreet. For a long time, apparently the fellow had told his wife, "Hey, that's Adolf Hitler."
Then his wife was fascinated. Yeah. That's Hitler.
Yeah.
Well, he was already well known,
obviously,
you know.
Oh, yeah.
And he was trying to have some little peace and quiet in Obersalzberg.
Mm-hmm. For a long time, a meeting had been arranged at Berchtesgaden. The moment came when it was no longer possible to avoid it. German Day at Berchtesgaden. Present, Comrade Adolf Hitler. Great sensation at Obersalzberg. The whole boarding house, 40 to 50 people in all, came down into the valley to see the phenomenon. Dinner time had been advanced so that they could arrive punctually. I came down by motorcycle. At the Crown Inn, I was welcomed by a formidable ovation. All my boarding house was gathered in front of the door. But the good people were in no way surprised, being convinced that every new arrival was greeted in this vociferous fashion. When I climbed on the platform, they stared at me as if I'd gone mad. When they became aware of the reality, I saw that it was driving them out of their minds. And what he's talking about here, Carolyn, is everybody realizing all this time it's been Adolf Hitler in their midst. Mm-hmm. And they had known him as Herr Wolf. And then when he steps up on that podium, it's like, oh, my.
Yeah, right.
When Wolf returned to the boarding house, the atmosphere there was poisoned. Those who had spoken ill of Adolf Hitler in my hearing were horribly embarrassed. What a pity. The peasant period was when my features weren't...
Now, the pleasant period.
The pleasant period was when my features weren't known, and I could travel in peace all over the Reich. What a pleasure it was for me to be mistaken for no matter whom. One of my first escapades after my emergence from prison in 1925 consisted in a visit to Berchtesgaden. I told the Buchners that I had work to do and needed absolute quiet. I accordingly installed myself in the small annex. Then the Buchners went away. I shall always follow their fortunes with interest. I judge people according to how they treated us at the period of our struggle. The Buchners were admirable to us at a time when we were weak. Buchner was a very nice fellow, and his wife was a person full of energy. They gave way in 1926 or 27 to Dressel, a Saxon. What a change. Now, what he's talking about right here, it'd be help as explanation, is that the Buchners ran this this boarding house or house, and they gave way to this fellow named Dressel. And when he took over, Hitler says, what a change. Dressel was horribly lazy. His house was ill-kept. His food uneatable. A drunken brother-in-law into the bargain. The cafe was kept by a charming girl who today works with, is that Amon?
Yeah, I guess. Amon.
Amon, and whom Dressel mistreated. She was the daughter of a porcelain manufacturer, Hutchenreuther, whose business had turned out badly. What a relief for her when Amon got her out of there. Dressel even withheld from his staff the 10% for service to which they were entitled, meaning he kept their tips. All this was so disgusting that we decided not to stay there any longer. After that, I stayed at the Marienheim. That's what it looks like, Marienheim. The Becksteins were there and had begged me to keep them company. But the atmosphere was intolerable. The Becksteins, who were people of the world, themselves admitted it. A society entirely lacking in naturalness, character swollen with pretentiousness, the quintessence of everything that revolts us. After the incident of her Motorsohn's luggage, I went away. I couldn't remain any longer in a house inhabited by such puppets. Then I selected the Deutsch House.
That's a Deutsche
House in Berchtesgaden. I lived there for nearly 2 years with breaks. I lived there like a fighting cock. Every day I went up to Obersalzberg, which took me 2.5 hours walking there and back. That's where I wrote the second volume of my book. I was very fond of visiting Dreimodel House, where there were always pretty girls. This was a great treat for me. There was one of them especially who was a real beauty.
Well, I like that he mentions the pretty girls. He always liked the company of women.
Yeah.
And but what's great here, I think, is that he says, that's where I wrote the second volume of my book. Now, he says this was 1925 or something. This is not Mein Kampf that he's talking about. Isn't he talking about his second book? What's called Hitler's second book?
Mm-hmm. That's what I
sometimes they call it Hitler's secret book, but that's not. It's just given the name because he never named it, but it's given the name his second book. Is that what you figured from reading?
Yeah, that's how I took it.
Well, see, you know, there's all these people who insist that he never wrote that book, that that's a fake too, a fraud, just
right.
Like Table Talk is supposed to be a fraud or something. But I read that book, and I thought it sounded like him, and now he's saying right here that he did write it. He wrote it there, and it can't be the second half of Mein Kampf.
Yeah, because that was already finished.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Good point.
So that's really, really quite a revelation here, I think.
Mm-hmm. In 1928, I learned that the Wachenfeld House would be coming up to let. I thought this would be an excellent solution, and I decided to go and look at it. Nobody was there. Old Rasp, whom I met there, told me that the two ladies had just gone out. Winter, who had had the house built, was at that time a big industrialist in Buxtehude. He'd given his wife's maiden name, Wachenfeld. The two ladies came back. "Excuse me, ladies, you are the proprietors of this house. I've been told that you wanted to let it. You are Herr Hitler? We are members of the party. Then we are wonderfully suited. Come in and have a cup of coffee." Then I visited the house and was completely captivated. We at once came to an agreement. The proprietors were delighted to let the entire house by the year for 100 marks a month. They considered that I was doing them a service in not leaving the house empty. They were so kind as to add that in the event of sale, which was improbable, they would give me the first option. I immediately rang up my sister in Vienna with the news and begged her to be so good as to take over the part of mistress of the house. Since my sister was often alone with a little servant girl, I procured two watchdogs for her. Nothing ever happened to her. I went once to Buxtehude.
Buxtehude.
Since I'd invested a lot of money in the house, I wanted a price, against the event of a sale, to be fixed before a lawyer. The most agreeable thing for me would have been to buy at once, but Frau Winter couldn't make up her mind to sell the house, which she had from her late husband. We had arrived by car from Hamburg. When I asked where was the Winter factory, I was told that it had burned down precisely the night before. I told myself I'd come at the proper moment. I visited Frau Winter in her house. I was received at first by her daughter. The mother came, beaming. "What a coincidence," she said. "You arrive, and the factory was burnt down last night. Two pieces of luck." The fact was that during the inflation, and he's talking about under the Weimar Republic here, two Jews had bought the factory for nothing, profiting by a widow's weakness. She added, "This is such a good day for me that I agree to sell you the house." She led me in front of a photograph. "Look at this scamp," she said. "For 3 weeks he's been with the army, and I've had no letter from him." I tried to explain to her that perhaps the young man was on maneuvers and unable to write. She was delighted that I'd supplied her with a pretext for regarding herself as having been unjust to the boy. I was entirely subjugated by this adorable old lady of 80. She reminded me of Frau Hoffmann, only taller, thinner, and more alert. I went for a short walk with the old lady and learnt that she had the right to dwell only in the house belonging to the factory. By good luck, although the lightning had struck the factory, the living house had been spared. That's how I became a property owner at Obersalzberg. Yes, there are so many links between Obersalzberg and me. So many things were born there and brought to fruition there. I've spent up there the finest hours of my life. My thoughts remain faithful to my first house. It's there that all my great projects were conceived and ripened. I had hours of leisure in those days, and how many charming friends. Now it's stultifying hard work and chains. All that's left of me now is those few hours that I spend with you every night. For the Baroness, I was somebody interesting. Eckert had introduced me as follows. "Here's a young friend who one day will be a very important man." How she wanted to know what I did. I told her I was a writer. How I loved going to see Dietrich Eckert in his apartment in the Franz Josef Strasse. What a wonderful atmosphere in his home. How he took care of his little Anna. When he died, she told me with all the tears of bitterness that she would never again meet a man as disinterested as he was. We've all taken a step forward on the road of existence, and we could no longer picture ourselves exactly what Dietrich Eckert was for us. He shone in our eyes like the polar star. What others wrote was so flat. When he admonished someone, it was with so much wit. At the time, I was intellectually a child, still on the bottle. But what comforted me was that even with him, it hadn't all sprouted of itself, that everything in his work was the result of a patient and intelligent effort. There are things I wrote 10 years ago that I can no longer read. Our society at the boarding house was composed of Dietrich Eckert with his girlfriend Anna of Ganser, the Baroness Abeg, Esser, Heinrich Hoffmann, and Drexler.
You know, when he says here, there are things I wrote 10 years ago that I can no
yes.
longer read.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it doesn't seem to exactly fit, but he says that at the time when Dietrich was, Eckert was still mm-hmm. alive, and this has been, in the 20s, he was still intellectually a child. So mm-hmm. think of all the speeches he gave and all the things he said, but he is saying by this that even what I wrote 10 years ago, I can't even read myself. I don't like it anymore.
Yes.
I'm changed. And this is something we've been talking about, how he changed over time. And the people who are insisting that, you know, in 1925 and before and a little after that, that he said these, he said certain things, that he can't possibly have said something contrary to that 20 years later. And he says even in 10 years he's changed his mind.
Yeah, how I took that when I read it, Carolyn, was that it showed what growth he had undergone. Because, yeah, you mentioned that he says, intellectually, he said, I was still a child on the bottle. But, and then all these things that he wrote back then, he couldn't have written anything differently because his level of knowledge and maturity and soaking up things from Eckhart was still growing. And so he passed
through
that.
Well, and soaking from his own experience and stuff, too. He didn't learn everything from Eckhart.
No, no, not
but,
at all.
But, you know, he's saying, see, this is 1942.
Mm-hmm.
He's speaking here. So 10 years ago was 1932.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
What you were saying.
Anyway, I just felt like it was showing his own growth that, you know, and I've written a lot of essays and things, and I'm sure you have too over the years. And I look at some things that I wrote back in 1970, and I think how naive, and I think, but at times there was a spark there that I thought, well, that's pretty good for, you know, a guy 30 years old at the time. But so I kind of related to what he said, and he said, you know, those things that he wrote back then. Not that they weren't valuable at all, but he couldn't stand to read them because he had grown so much.
Yeah, he didn't like them anymore.
Right.
And he thought, did I write that?
Mm-hmm. Our society at the boarding house, I read that with Drexler. I remember bringing up from Birch's Garden.
Well, you can repeat that because it's kind of hard to read.
Our society at the boarding house was composed of Dietrich Eckhart with his girlfriend Anna of Ganser, the Baroness Abegg, Esser, Heinrich Hoffmann, and Drexler. I remember bringing up from Berchtesgaden in a basket a bust acquired by the Baroness that everybody attributed to Donatello. I regretted the sweat it cost me all the more since when I dragged it from the basket. It proved to be a bad copy in clay. We often spent agreeable evenings in the Deutsche House, sometimes in the cafe, sometimes in one or other of our rooms. Ganser used to fill the house with the booming of his voice and his Bavarian accent. He scented traces of plots everywhere. Is that Mizell was a delightful girl. At this period, I knew a lot of women. Several of them became attached to me. Why, then, didn't I marry? To leave a wife behind me? At the slightest imprudence, I ran the risk of going back to prison for 6 years. Imprudence, yeah. So there could be no question of marriage for me. I therefore had to renounce certain opportunities that offered themselves. Dr. Ganser deserves eternal gratitude from the party. I owe him a whole series of very important relationships. If I hadn't, thanks to him, made the acquaintance of Richard Frank, the wheat man, I wouldn't have been able to keep the Beobachter going in 1923. That was the party's newspaper. The same is true of Bechstein. For months, I traveled in his car when it was loaded with dynamite. He used to say, to calm me, I can't use any other chauffeur, for this one is so completely stupid that I can say anything at all in front of him. If he runs into another car, it can't be helped. Up in the air we'll go. When it was a question of setting off on a journey, Eckhart was the most precise man on earth, Ganser the most imprecise. Eckhart would arrive at the station an hour and a half before the train's departure. Ganser was never there. Eckhart used to say to me, have you any news of Ganser? I'm afraid he's late again. You, don't go away or I'll be left alone. The train would be leaving the platform when we would see Ganser overflowing with his luggage, having traversed the whole train after having succeeded in bringing off a flying leap into the last carriage. Eckhart would apostrophize him. You're a man born after his time. That explains everything. Eckhart was born a Protestant. When he was with Ganser, he used to defend Catholicism. And quoting Eckhart here, but for Luther, who gave Catholicism new vigor, we'd have finished with Christianity much sooner. Ganser, as a pastor's son, used to defend Luther. One day, Eckhart brought their traditional dispute to the following conclusion. I must tell it to you now. You're merely a subproduct of Protestant sexuality, that is to say, of a sexuality that's not at ease in good society. Anyway, I had a great number of loyal supporters in Munich. They had everything to lose by adopting this position and nothing to win. Today, when I happen to meet one of them, it moves me extraordinarily. They showed a truly touching attachment towards me. Some stall keepers of the markets used to come running to see me to bring a couple of eggs to Herr Hitler. There were important ones like Paschal, Fuess, and Gar, but also quite small men whom today I find much aged. I'm so fond of these unpretentious fellows. The others, the 10,000 of the elite, whatever they do is the result of calculation. Some of them see me as an attraction to their drawing rooms. Others seek various advantages. Our newspaper sellers were often boycotted and beaten up. One of our most faithful supporters since 1920 was old Yegg. My happiest memories are of this time. The attachment I then felt to the people has never left me. There are such bonds joining me to them that I can share in their troubles and joys. I put myself spontaneously in their place. For years, I lived on Tyrolean apples, and so did Hess. It's crazy what economies we had to make. Every mark saved was for the party. Another loyal supporter was little Neuner, Ludendorff's valet. There were also noblemen, Stransky, Schubner-Richter, von der Forten. I realized the similarity of opposites. My comrades at the beginning already came from all parts of Germany. Nothing in the groundwork of the party has changed. I still rely on the same forces. It's a great time when an entirely unknown man can set out to conquer a nation, and when after 15 years of struggle, he can become, in effect, the head of his people. I had the luck to number some strong personalities among my supporters. So, that closes that long section.
Uh-huh. That's very good. What do you want to say about it?
Well, it meant a lot to me because taking him back to those early years of his struggles, when his existence was precarious, the authorities wanted him shut up, and yet he had the determination and grit to stay with it, overcoming obstacles, and it shows that he couldn't have done it without the little people that took care of him, helped keep him hidden when he wanted to be hidden, and all that. But, you know, it's Hitler in the formative stage. It's not the man up in front of the podium leading National Socialist Germany. It's it's more of a man. Well, he was still of the people as the Führer, of course, but it's a man that had not yet been recognized for what he was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, and you know, I think it shows to me that he has he's able to speak in a very sincere and open about mm-hmm. feelings and so on.
Exactly.
About people. I wish I had thought about how to say this previously.
Well, not rigid and unemotional.
Well, yeah, and he's not afraid to express his feelings and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And he's always says, and I think he's very sincere about it, the good relationship he has with the common people. And
yes.
That he experienced this early, but he would have it anyway because he's not a pretentious person. He's never been a pretentious person. And he hates pretension.
Sure.
And that's why he had a dislike of so many of those politicians, those allied politicians who are so pretentious, mm-hmm. like, say, Chamberlain.
Right.
Even though Chamberlain went along with him, he still didn't like Chamberlain with his umbrella. And but, you know, he's and here he's saying, and also he's generous-minded. He never fails to give others credit. He's not taking a bunch of credit in this all this thing he's talking about here.
Right.
He's giving credit to all kinds of people.
Sure.
And that it's not, you said the little people, but he did point out that also noblemen were his loyal supporters, and so it was a mixture of all people from all over Germany and all types of people. But the little people, I think, touched him the most.
Mm-hmm.
Because he said they had nothing to gain and everything to lose.
That's right.
But they sincerely felt something for him, and they would do all kinds of little favors for him and bring him things. And, you know, and that is very touching when that happens.
And saying things like that, Carolyn, is it's got to give us a little bit of glimmer of hope, because what he's saying is that people who thought like they did at that time and supported them and their ideology were risking everything and could gain nothing. They could lose everything, and it's because they were very much a minority with their viewpoints. And so, you know, you think of today and ourselves and the people that are listening tonight, we're very much the minority. We're frowned upon,
mm-hmm.
and things like this. And yet there may be a light at the tunnel. And you look at something of what his party grew into. And so the possibilities, you know,
you just never know.
Yeah,
the right people leading things. Well, yes. We're going to have to say goodnight now.
Right.
We've used up our full time. And I want to thank you all for listening. And we will be back next week, beginning on the night of 17th and 18th of January. Good night.
All right. Thanks, folks. Good night.